So, the name of this talk is Reverence as a Path, or even Bowing in Reverence as a Path. And I'm going to start by reading a quotation from a book called Ritual and Devotion in Buddhism. Socrates used to say that to know the good was sufficient. Doing the good, he said, would automatically follow from knowing it. This may have been true for Socrates, but it is certainly not true for the vast majority of us. For us, virtuous action by no means follows automatically upon knowledge of what is right. And why this should be so can be glimpsed in a criticism that Aristotle leveled against Socrates. Socrates, he said, left altogether out of account what Aristotle called the irrational parts of the soul. The point at issue between these two philosophers of ancient Greece raises what is one of the basic problems of the spiritual life, the problem of how to translate knowing into being. To know and understand the truth, to gain an intuitive glimpse of the truth, is difficult enough, but to embody it in one's life and begin is 100 times more difficult. So from this quotation, the words of Sangharakshita, who is the writer, those words that I am the most interested in for the purpose of this talk is the problem of how to translate knowing into being. In a way, you could say that this is the whole purpose of Buddhist practice, to translate knowing into being. Translating knowing into being is true insight and brings true insight into operation in our lives. And I'm going to say tonight, and I do believe this as well, that this is also the function of reverence, or at least one of the functions of reverence, to allow us to bring insight into our lives, specifically to change us into beings who are receptive to insight, even who might revere insight. So I'm going to talk about reverence, and I'm going to talk specifically about reverence as a path that unifies us and brings what we know into our lives. Just because this is the FWBO and we always do this, I will talk about the Latin derivation of the word revere very briefly. So it means to stand in awe of. And also, I was very delighted to notice that the evere part in revere is related to the word aware. So when we are practicing reverence, we are aware of something. So what I'm going to try to explore in this talk, and I probably won't answer it, but anyway, what we're going to explore is when we are revering, what are we aware of? How do we revere? How does this contribute to our practice, and how does it help us to gain insight into the nature of reality, which is, of course, the usual way of talking about the goal of Buddhist practice. And so a note about something that happened when my mother came on a retreat I was leading. So we went to a restaurant or something afterwards. We were chatting, and she was completely freaked out by all of the bowing that went on this retreat. It turned out she kept it shut on the retreat. But then we got to the restaurant, and so her view was that when you bow to something, you are saying, in so many words, that you are a jerk. And you probably guess those are my words, not hers, but so you are a jerk, and the thing that you're bowing to is not a jerk. The thing that you're bowing to is the opposite of a jerk. And so body language of a bow says is that we are unworthy. I was reflecting on this, and I was reflecting how this is how her conditioning was, how her past was. So she completely rejected religion. So I grew up without any religion at all. And so I have quite a different point of view from her on what it means to bow. So when we bow, are we saying we're unworthy? Or is that, you know, like when we just did that exercise, is that maybe somewhere, you know, in our experience of what we think that might mean? So I have another quotation here from a seminar held by Sangharakshita, and it's actually on the Metta Sutta, but it's relevant to what I'm talking about now. So he's talking about this word in Pali, atta, A-T-T-H-A. He says, atta means good. It also means goal, one's aim. There is a connection between one's good and one's goal or aim. Something can hardly be said to be your goal or your aim in the true sense unless it is also good for you, unless it is also your good. But here the suggestion is that the aim or the good is the ultimate good or the ultimate aim, for the sake of which all lesser goals or lesser goods exist. I think that it's Mrs. Rice Davids who, in some of her writings about early Buddhism, makes the point that early in the Buddha's teaching career, the word atta was very much in use, that nibbana wasn't much used, and the word bodhi wasn't even used very much. But atta was very much referred to. It's the goal with a capital G, as it were. For instance, it might be asked, why does somebody go forth, or why does somebody meditate? It's for the sake of the goal, the aim, the good, in that highest sense. It's a useful term. It just conveys a sense of something higher, something even ultimate, toward which you are making your way, which is your aim, which is your goal, which is your good. So I'll just say that one more time. It conveys a sense of something higher, something even ultimate, toward which you are making your way, which is your aim, which is your goal, which is also your good. When we bow, when I bow, I might be able to say what the Buddha was doing when he bowed. When we revere in that way, when we make an offering, we are bowing to the good, to atta, revering the good, offering something to the good. We are revering the good in ourselves and in the object of reverence. So revering the good in ourselves and in the object of reverence. And we do this when we bow. We do this when we act out a ritual of goodness. We attune ourselves more wholly to the good. So later on this evening, we will be doing a ritual of goodness. And in the meantime, I have another quote. This was something that was written by Lama Suryadas. Many of us have seen the Dalai Lama in pictures or on TV, if not in person, putting his palms together before his face or at his chest and bowing to whomever he meets, whether person to person or before a large audience. He is bowing to the Buddha, the good, within each being and inviting entrance therein. This is a way of practicing what we believe on a regular basis, of training ourselves in the highest, deepest mystical principles through a simple daily exercise, which can make every single encounter deeply meaningful. I myself feel that when we bow, we lower our guard and surrender to our innate spiritual nature, or Buddha nature. Placing ourselves closer to the earth, as we do when we bow, we get closer to our own ground of being. So to repeat once more, the Dalai Lama is bowing to the Buddha, the good, within each being and inviting entrance therein. So this is the practice of reverence and what we might hope to gain from it, or what we might hope to lose from it. Later on, we're going to be doing what's called a threefold puja. This is a ritual of reverence to what are known as the three jewels or the three treasures of Buddhism. The first line is, we reverence the Buddha. The Buddha who was and who is also a symbol of human goodness. We are, of course, included in this. In revering the Buddha, we celebrate our own goodness and the deeply innate goodness of living beings. In celebrating this, we feel our hearts in a new way, which is the point. Then we reverence the Dharma, or the truth. As we heard the early Buddhist suttas or discourses, there wasn't much mention of trying to become enlightened. The goal of practice was conceived as the good. In revering the Dharma, we celebrate our ever-deepening understanding of, our ever-deepening manifesting of, the good that was exemplified and taught by the Buddha. More and more over time, we align ourselves with the good. This is our reverence for the Dharma. We reverence the Sangha, the community of practitioners, the context in which our practice of love, wisdom, and tolerance is unfolding in real time with real people. In revering the Sangha, we celebrate something characterized by unfailing mutual delight. Sangharakshita says, communication and taking delight are the essence of friendship, the essence of the Sangha. So our love for one another, our honesty with each other, our care for one another, our awareness of each other, this is our reverence for the Sangha. So in the Mitra ceremony later on, which will take place in the context of the threefold puja, we will be revering the three jewels in this way. So that's all it is. We will be ceremonially communicating and taking delight, opening to our good. When we bow, we do this with our body. And when we recite, we do it with our voice. So I'm going to just say a little bit about religion and the rational mind, and then I'll say a little bit about, then I'll just wrap it up, basically. One of my favorite quotes from Shunryu Suzuki, who's the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, is the following. Usually when someone believes in a particular religion, his attitude becomes more and more a sharp angle pointing away from himself. In our way, the point of the angle is always toward ourselves. So I think what makes something a religion rather than a mere philosophy is reverence. Mere philosophy is subject to the criticism that was leveled against Socrates. It cannot find its way into our actual lives. It cannot express itself in human form. My own definition of religion is that it is like a philosophical structure meant to evoke the realization that everything is constructed, including and especially what we refer to as ourselves. Having the freedom to see ourselves as a product of shifting conditions is perhaps the most difficult and most important insight that we can have. This is called in Pali anatta. I think of it not so much as the absence of something like a self, but as an attitude that is warm and bright and free. This is what we can realize at least ritually when we bow and when we practice reverencing the good in the form of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the reverence we express toward the good through ritual or bowing or in whatever way is non-linear. It's not operating on the level of a textbook. It is supra-intelligent, and that's what allows it to reach our hearts and our emotions in a way that a textbook cannot. It will be difficult if we think that the good is our rational mind. The good is not separate from our rational mind, nor is it exclusively identified with it. Just as we are animals, we have instincts, we are biology to some extent, this is not all we are, according to Buddhism. We sleep, we have sex, we comfort our young, we live more or less in groups. These are things that mammals do. The good includes and reaches all these parts of us, even parts of us that we ourselves are unwilling to accept. We don't have to find the good or develop the good. We have simply to open ourselves to what we are. Our rational mind is one of our greatest gifts. But I think it's good to ask how great our attachment is to our rational mind. To use traditional Buddhist terminology, do we go for refuge to our rational mind? If so, does this shut out other kinds of experiences? This is something that we can reflect on and be aware of. So the final point I want to make about religion is probably the most obvious one. And this is, of course, the danger of practicing ritual or reverence in a way that is not helpful or that is even harmful. This is not only possible, but as we know, it is very common. Because we tend to, well, at least one reason is because we lose our attentiveness to things that we do over and over again. We go through motions, we forget why we are doing things. It's very easy for us to lose sight of our purpose. We may meditate in order to feel good. We may simply try to be a good Buddhist. We may forget about insight. We may be satisfied with just being a little bit happier. In Buddhism, this is a well-known risk, commonly called the fetter of reliance on rites and rituals as ends in themselves. Sangharakshita, I think, brilliantly interprets this as the fetter of superficiality. The fetter of superficiality keeps us on the surface of our own experience and keeps us safely away from the intrinsic awareness, the awareness intrinsic to reverence, the reality of suffering, for example, and its causes. Reverence, spiritual practice in general, requires ongoing effort toward awareness and creativity. We can never settle down. Rituals are not magic. Rather, true awareness, receptivity, and engagement are magic. The degree that we bring these things to our practice of reverence is the measure of their power. If you would like to pursue this topic further, I recommend the book quoted at the beginning of this talk, Ritual and Devotion in Buddhism by Sangharakshita. I also recommend showing up to some Buddhist places around town and seeing what they do. Check out the rituals and check out ways people have devised of connecting with the good and see how it affects you, see if it has any meaning for you. We also do pujas here occasionally. In fact, the subject of the next 2 weeks, I think as somebody mentioned at Sangha Night, is ritual and devotion. But we can also engage more fully in the rituals that we do every day. We don't have to be in this room singing a Sanskrit song. For example, we thank people all the time. Are we aware when we do this? Are we aware of people? Are we aware of ourselves when we say hello or when we say goodbye? Really, everything we say is a ritual of some kind. Everything we say has potential benefits if we bring awareness and reverence to it. Everything we say and everything we do. Real life is what we reverence, but so often we are not paying attention. I'm just going to end by talking about, kind of summarizing and talking about the benefits of practicing reverence. As one psychologist, whose name I unfortunately cannot pronounce, which I apologize for, pointed out, there's part of our psyche that doesn't know the difference between a ritual and an actual event. So I think this is also part of the power that happens when we practice reverence. When we practice reverence, we're working directly with this part of ourselves. When we practice reverence, we are engaging different aspects of our mind, our emotions, and our unconscious than we ordinarily do. We are engaging in something that I think potentially can be very healing to us. I think it could possibly be healing physically, but I guess I mainly mean, psychically or mentally. Practicing reverence can help us relax around our sense of separation, especially from other forms of life, especially other people. Practicing reverence can help us, get in touch with, a kind of realistic and non-self-deprecating humility, which just is the truth that we have more to learn in this life. And then I think one of the main things that I've benefited from in doing these kinds of practices is just having receptivity, cultivating receptivity and openness. So I think all these things are benefits, and I think they're also just what we're doing when we're doing the practice. When we practice reverence, we release what are called wrong views in Buddhism. We release the effects of past negative karma that remain as obstacles to our understanding and obstacles to our bringing what we know into our lives. So if these are the things you want to cultivate in your practice, try reverence.